Okay. I'm out on a bike ride right now, but I had a thought I wanted to share with you while I'm doing it. So if you hear some noises, I'm out on my bike. Here's the thing. When kids are growing up in an environment where the parents are telling the children to do and say things that or that they cannot do and say things that they see their parents doing. You know, and this can be a lot of different things. This can be, you know, starting out with the obvious, but it can get so controlling that it gets down to the minute. Like, you know, use your manners, requiring them to speak in a certain way when they already have a limited vocabulary, making them eat a certain way before they're ready to accept those sorts of things as a ritual of, you know, eating politeness or whatever. That's another way you rook them. You get them into minding before they're ready to, because you're ready for them to already be grown up and they don't even know how to talk yet. So anyway, so a kid that gets raised in an environment that's got that kind of discontinuity where the child doesn't have a large vocabulary at that time. He's in his right brain mostly, and he learns by observation, and he mimics it because he is instinctively driven to model the behavior of those around him to survive. He's preparing himself to be like them. So when he hears the message that, well, you know, I can curse like a sailor, but if I catch you, I'm gonna whip your butt. He sees that when you're a big person, it's your job to beat up little people with anger and with malice and with intent to hurt and without care for their feelings. And they can cry about it, and they know that no one's coming, you know? So they're powerless. They learn powerless and helpless. And why do they teach them powerless and helpless? Because they say they need to mind. And so they put obedience ahead of everything else, and they screw the child up for life. It's basically what happens. The way they do that is they promote the idea to them that the only reason they're a child that's going to ever make it into adulthood is by obeying their parents. And, you know, there are different ways to do that. Teaching a kid how to survive doesn't have to include traumatizing a kid by smacking him or punishing him in ways that lead him to mistrust his parents. Because that's what you're going to do. If you punish a child physically, you're going to teach him to lie. Now, why is that? Because he really doesn't like to be hit that way. I mean, I don't know if of any child who says, "Oh, mama, spank me one more time." And if they do, they probably got it from some perverse idea on TV. But they, you know, what I'm saying is that they don't want to get hit. So for them, part of survival is not getting hit. That's a natural instinct, okay? So their instinct is going to be to try and figure out a way, using their left brain, to get out of that. So they lie, because they don't want to get hit. And what do they get for that? They get hit. So they learn to keep things to themselves. They are afraid of revealing their truth, because they might get hit. They seek out friends who have that kind of thing in common, and then those friends become the comrades who help them get through their childhood, because the parents' best efforts to be parents are driving the kids crazy. If you've got a drinker in the house, doesn't matter who, things get even worse. Because the drinker only thinks about the drinker. And that's what makes him and his presence in a family a problem. Because he's not part of the family anymore. He wants the family to revolve around him, to support him and his reasons for drinking. Now, if she's driving him in that direction, then he's just doing it to survive. It's just his way of relieving the pain of anguish and anxiety and anger that he would otherwise direct, you know, to a door or a punching bag or somebody else. He's doing it to self-medicate his problems away from the conflicts that are being created at home. So if he's trying to provide for his family and he's with a narcissist or some other cluster B disordered woman, he's going to be getting driven crazy at home with insatiable demands for change, usually in the materialistic world, in sort of a never-ending, insatiable desire to chase down the next material thing, kind of like mainstream society, who thinks that, you know, the next big boat or the next Cadillac is somehow going to provide them with some sort of bliss and ecstasy that they've been seeking their whole life. And I don't know how you come out of, you know, the uterus and wind up in a Cadillac and think that's the answer to life. But, you know, if people didn't think that way, they probably wouldn't sell a lot of Cadillacs. If they wasn't for advertising, I doubt we'd have a lot of that kind of stuff to begin with. So what happens is, a kid lives in this dichotomous world where it's do as I say and not as I do. And so what happens is they wind up minding until they leave the parents, and then they act just like them. So for all of their efforts to try and get their kids to be different based on them standing there drinking and smoking and maybe smoking weed and acting the way they do and all of this good stuff, it only works until the kids leave home. And then the kids get busy recreating their family, using themselves as the new positions. And they may do it differently here or there, but they're still bound by the mark that was left on them by their parents. And so they may go to extremes to avoid that kind of stuff, or to be the opposite of their parents, or to be in an opposition to the way they got treated, and they'll let it define their lives. They're still thinking in a dichotomous way. It's polarity. They're going to the opposite side because the water, you know, they perceive that's how far you got to go to get away from what they experienced. You know, some people wind up just like their parents and wind up abusing their children as well. If physical abuse was part of their growing up, other parents will say, you know what, that did nothing for me. I'm not going to do that to my child. And so they won't. They'll find alternative ways to deal with their children, like compromising, like letting their child be involved in the consequences, such as letting them pick out what they might think is appropriate from a selection of ideas, so that they're involved in the process, so that they can learn to be doing the process for themselves as adults. You see, that's what parents are failing to do. They got to understand that kids model their parents' behavior, and that doesn't mean just tell the kid how to live while you live your life in a cruddy way. They're going to see what you're doing, and as soon as they grow up, they're going to live just like you. And that's what they're going to do. And it's causing a lot of fucked up families in the world. And they don't even know why. But what it is they find and run into somebody who's growing up in a very similar family environment. And so they have this fallen hero, comrade, like they went through a battle and can share their wounds because they're similar, from similar backgrounds. And so they feel a camaraderie, and it helps them glue. And they need to, because they've been in a family system that's left them feeling more lonely than they would have if they were actually alone. What I mean by that is, you know, when a child seeks out comfort and gets scolded, what does he learn? You know, from a parent who's talking on the phone and too busy to comfort the kid. You know, what does he learn? He learns that when he asks for affection or security, you know, or for comfort, that he's going to get punished. So what does he do? He stops doing it. So you're teaching your kid how to lie because you hit him. And he's terrified of that. So to avoid it, he'll lie to your face. And the longer you keep this up, the better liar he's going to become, until he's telling you stories, and he ought to be a book writer. Because that's what they are too. They're masterful story weavers. Where'd they get that from? Practice lying. So it's probably a pretty good bet that a lot of people wind up in the fiction business because it makes you feel better, don't you think? Pick up a story. Does it mean anything? You get involved. It's meditation. Makes you feel better. You don't know why, but you like it. Well, that's what it does. It takes you out of the cares of this world. And once you do it, and you learn what it does, you want to do it all the time. And people get stuck that way a lot. For instance, you might find out that you reach the zone when you bicycle, or some other previously, you know, instructed physical activity that you can put on automatic and get into what I call the zone. And time flies by, you look at the clock, it's already been an hour and a half, you didn't expect to ride that long. You just get lost in your thoughts, and everything feels good. The endorphins kick in, and they help quell any distractions from your body while you're trucking along. And it's easy to appreciate everything in the here and now, because there's no before and later. There's no before and after. It's just me and the bike going down the road. You know, I run my sniffer, see how stuff smells, look at the sky. It's fun. But it gets me in this mood where I'm receptive to ideas that I didn't think before, because now my mind is calm and I'm not thinking about the cares of the world. So when you get a chance to shut your mind down, you get a chance to receive. You can't receive if you're talking all the time. So when you get into meditation and you shut down your thoughts, it's a time when the thoughts can come to you. Because when you're always talking to yourself, you're broadcasting. And you're doing the talking. And you typically, if you're like most people, you can't shut up. You absolutely can't shut up. You talk to yourself all day, which makes it funny when people think it looks funny when they see someone talking to themselves. Because really all they're doing is adding another connection to the process of thinking, right? They're thinking, now they're thinking out loud, and everybody thinks they're funny for doing it. Hang on, I gotta go up the hill. Okay, I made it up the hill. There's some guy with a lawnmower. I'm at the Philippi State Park in Safety Harbor, Florida. And today they're apparently running and mowing the grass. So anyways, we're talking about what happens when kids mimic their parents' behavior and are suppressed from doing so by their parents. And as soon as they leave home, they act just like, or some variation thereof. Well, the only way to stop that is to become aware that these processes, the way they think, the way they think family systems operate were all learned at a time when they didn't even remember learning it anymore. Most people can't remember their first tricycle ride. And I postulate that after a period of time, they don't remember how they learned the way they are. But the way they are, they learned before they can remember learning. You know what I mean? Their left brain hadn't caught on to recording events like it does now at an older age. And so a lot of these things seem to come from what people call the subconscious, but they're not. They're not. They're not even suppressed. They're just too old, and they're not recognizable because those places, those memories didn't have a file to go to. We didn't even know we needed to keep track of. It wasn't until later that we started recording, right? So we learn these behaviors, these ways to be, very quickly. We see the roles. And so we operate within those systems for a while, you know? It takes a bit to grow up, even though our lives are short in comparison, you know, to what the universe is. It's interesting that as adults, we tend to take our private lives and operate under those principles we learned from our parents as kids. We don't do any research about it. We don't look it up. We don't seek to find out whether the way we were raised was the greatest way there is. And then there's people who do think like that. And you know, that's not a bad thing to do, is to figure out what's the best way after learning about all the ways. But as far as I'm concerned, after doing that, you know, with a master's degree in mental health counseling from the University of South Florida about 19 years ago, I think that the roles we play based on the childhood traumatic experiences that we experienced have a significant impact on the way we conduct ourselves as adults. And the solution to me is healthy relationships built on respect and what I call a solution-oriented response. And in the next four podcasts, I'm going to be going over what healthy relationships consist of and how you can use them in your lives to greatly increase the amount of joy in your life and those around you. All right. I'll talk to you.